From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The occupation of Iraq isn't getting any easier, and neither is the conversation over the case for war that preceded it. On Wednesday, President Bush backed away from suggestions that Saddam Hussein was involved with the attacks of 9/11, something implied just this past weekend by Vice President Cheney.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with September the 11th.
That may have come as a surprise to many Americans, nearly 70% of whom, according to a Washington Post poll, still see a link. This hour, On Point, the winding case for war and its implications for the U.S. occupation of Iraq. We begin with a look at public opinion on the war. Andrew Kohut directs the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. I asked him how the public is absorbing the claims and counterclaims coming out of the White House this week.
The public is really the player in the argument here, because large percentages of Americans this year and in the run-up to the war in 2002 said they thought Saddam Hussein was involved. And the question is, how did they come to that conclusion? Were they led by the administration or and the pro-war forces, or as an inference that they drew innocently on their own?
Well, take us through some of the numbers. What do we actually see about that particular presumption and about general support for the war now?
Well, about 70% of Americans have told us that they thought somehow Saddam Hussein was involved in the 9/11 attacks. That percentage was almost that high this year after the war in a poll conducted by the Washington Post. So there hadn't been much change in that perception.
And in fact, now, there was a poll, what was it, a Time CNN poll 2 days after the September 11th attacks where 78% said they suspected Saddam Hussein's involvement.
Yeah, and I think it's less a matter of the public having a clear, some clear evidence or even hearing from someone about this, but an inference that they conclude Saddam Hussein is a bad guy from a dangerous part of the world, and the American public is quite ready to say, and has been quite ready to say, he probably had a hand in this. But what we found, and I think this is the most important thing because it extends to attitudes today, and it isn't so much this notion that Saddam Hussein was involved. It's the view that the war in Iraq was part of the war on terrorism. That was what made for American support such as it was to go to war. It's what is now sustaining that decision, even in the face of a situation that's getting increasingly bad for American forces and stabilizing Iraq. We still have most people, two-thirds, saying we made the right decision in going to war, even though only 20% or less are saying things are going very well. Reason, the American public still thinks that this was the right decision in terms of the war on terrorism, and this is part of the war on terrorism.
What do the polls say about how the public is absorbing the mounting cost of the war?
There's a lot of reluctance to spend this money. At the same time, the polls show little indication that the public wants to cut and run. So we get large percentages in the surveys saying that, boy, $87 billion, that's too much money. On the other hand, most polls also show two-thirds of the public say we've got to stay there. We've got to stay the course. We just can't walk away from it.
Over time, as a pollster, how do you imagine those seem like contradictory stances on the public's part? How are they likely to play out?
My guess is that the more important attitude is we got to stay there. You know, there's a fair amount of sticker shock when you come to numbers that big. People say, wow, $87 billion, it's a lot of money. But they recognize that this is an important thing to do. Now, the most critical thing that seems to be changing is whether the war has had a positive effect or a negative effect on the war on terrorism here at home. Right after, in May or in late April, the ABC poll was finding most Americans saying it's reducing the chances of terrorism, the war in Iraq. Now the public is more divided about it, and I think that's the critical change. If there's any change that might undermine the public's strong backing for President Bush on the war on terrorism, it's this notion of whether this big decision that he made about going to war in Iraq was the wrong one with regard to the war on terrorism, because the war on terrorism is what it's all about from the point of view of the American public.
So how does the dust up in Washington this week figure into public opinion? You had Vice President Cheney coming out last weekend and suggesting, again, a link between 9/11 and Saddam Hussein, and then the president coming out on Wednesday and explicitly saying there is not a connection. How does that get absorbed?
Well, I'm not so sure that the public is going to be paying very close attention to that kind of rhetoric. I think that of the news that happened this week about Iraq, it's more the continuing casualties, the deaths, the chaos that seems to be apparent in a large section of Iraq. And my guess is that the debate about who said what is less important to the public than the question of where do we go from here.
And if there's not a weapons of mass destruction rationale and there's not an explicit 9/11 rationale, at least not one that's sustained explicitly by the White House, do you think the general war on terror rubric umbrella is enough?
It will depend on whether we continue to have this drip, drip, drip. If we continue to have this drip, 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 at one point the public will make a calculation. Wow, the costs have been very, very high. And for what? It really hasn't helped the war on terrorism, and you know that situation isn't very good. On the other hand, most people still say, I saw a poll the other day, a national poll with most people saying, we still have fewer casualties than we expected, even given the most recent casualties. So the drip, drip, drip hasn't gotten to a point where the public says the costs are too high.
And meanwhile, there has been no further substantial terror attack in the United States that might suggest that it's not working.
Right. The Fox poll found most Americans thinking we're winning the war on terrorism. Most other polls show that the public doesn't think we're winning the war on the economy, and that's why the public is beginning to shift its priorities and say it's more the economy than terrorism.
And as an election year issue, the fighting in Iraq, how do you see it playing out?
Well, if it continues to be bad for us, continues to be unstable and have a lot of casualties, and the argument grows that this didn't make us safer, it might be ammunition for the Democrats that this was not a good move in terms of the war on terrorism. On the other hand, if things stabilize, the president will continue to enjoy his strong standing on dealing with terror.
Andrew Kohut, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Andrew Kohut is the director of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. He spoke with me from Washington. As American forces awake to their 26th week in Iraq, the Bush administration finds itself in the awkward position of having, once again, to make the case for war. The WMD argument has drifted into silence, and the Iraqi people are not acting as liberated as the administration had hoped. At home, support for the effort in Iraq remains strong. But as its cost rises and presidential politics heat up, the shifting rationales for war themselves become an issue in American credibility and the occupation's longer-term staying power. Are you one of the 70% of Americans who believe that Iraq was involved with the 9/11 attacks? Does the president's statement this week change your mind about the war, about its aftermath? And what is the case for war now? Is it strong enough to bear any burden? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Los Angeles is Mike Schuster, political correspondent for National Public Radio. Good evening and welcome, Mike Schuster.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Mike, what a week it's been. The vice president came out, six days ago, mm-hmm. Sunday, and said on Meet the Press, implied this connection between Iraq and 9/11. And then just a flurry of comments from Condoleezza Rice, from Donald Rumsfeld, from the president itself. What is the after-action analysis of what went on here? This is usually a very tightly knit crew.
You know, I'm not sure that I can answer that question. I think what happened was that Tim Russert brought up the issue of a link between the September 11th attacks and Saddam Hussein to Cheney when he interviewed him on Meet the Press. Mm-hmm. And Cheney, I think, provoked the controversy by saying it's not surprising that people make that connection. Russert said, but is there a connection? Cheney said, we don't know, but then went on to make what is believed to be a case of contacts between al-Qaeda and the Iraqi government under Saddam Hussein over the course of the last few years. But then Cheney concluded by saying the U.S. is striking by going to war in Iraq, the U.S. is striking a blow right at the heart of the base, the geographic base of the terrorists who had us under assault now for many years, but most especially on 9/11. Those are Cheney's words. So Cheney really provoked this. And as a result, a lot of reporters started asking anybody and everybody in the administration, is this the position of the administration? And then on Tuesday, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld came out and said, well, I know of no such connection. Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, made the same point on Nightline that night. And then Bush himself from the Oval Office was asked the question again by a reporter. And he said, we know of no evidence that there's a connection between Saddam Hussein and September 11th.
It seemed as though, Mike, the vice president, many people had tiptoed up to this line, but somehow he just subtly crossed it. There had been many implications previously, had there not, even from the president, of a connection here.
Well, that's right. And I can't speak for Vice President Cheney about why he did it or why he wanted to do it. There has been a long debate within the administration, starting immediately after the September 11th attacks, about whether Iraq was involved and whether Iraq should be attacked. And if you read Bob Woodward's book, Bush at War, you see that on September 17th, just 6 days after the September 11th attacks, Bush is quoted as saying, I believe Iraq was involved, but we don't have the evidence, so we can't attack them now. As far as I know, the White House has never challenged that quote, so we have to assume that Bush actually said that in a meeting of his national security advisors on September 17th. But then, of course, the administration focuses on Afghanistan. But by April of 2002, President Bush was saying over and over again that regime change was the policy of his administration. And you can find any number of comments and speeches by the president and others subtly or perhaps not so subtly linking Iraq to the terrorist attacks without ever actually coming out and saying Saddam Hussein did this.
Mike, does the rationale, which has clearly shifted, there were weapons of mass destruction, there was liberation, these each have been tamped down in different degrees. There was this floating issue of a connection to 9/11, but in the administration's calculation, in the global view, does the detail of the rationale matter at this point?
Well, I think the detail matters a great deal, especially because the administration is now negotiating with members of the UN Security Council for some kind of a new arrangement in Iraq that will internationalize the process and allow the UN Security Council to bestow a stamp of legitimacy on whatever government in Iraq emerges, and that's very important. And so as a result of those negotiations and those contacts, I think that this somewhat open sore of the reasons why the United States went to war and went to war without Security Council support get reopened. And I think that may, in fact, be the subtext for why all this has taken place. By the way, the issue of weapons of mass destruction is going to come back. I don't think it's finished entirely. David Kaye is working for the CIA. He was a former weapons inspector, and he's been working for a couple of months now in Iraq with more than 1,000 U.S. weapons inspectors. And we expect to hear a report from him possibly as early as next week. And I suspect that that will reopen again the controversy over weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
And the early signs, if there are any, are people expecting him to say, we have evidence, or still an empty bucket?
Well, I think that what a lot of people are expecting him to do is make the best case for this that the administration can make at this point, in the face of the fact that no large stocks of chemical or biological weapons have actually been found. There's still the question, a number of open questions that were never solved about where all the chemical and biological agent and stocks of toxins, that kind of thing, actually went. And that has to be explained. And I think that this report is expected to at least to begin that explanation.
Now, at the UN, where the U.S. is looking for international support, are you saying that France and Germany are going to keep the U.S. over a barrel until Washington, I don't know, concedes something, admits something?
No, I don't think that I'm saying that. I don't think it'll be that direct. But I do think that there's a great deal of sensitivity at the UN about the reasons that the rationalizations and reasons that the United States put forward for going to war and the fact that the Bush administration has not been able to support that in the post-war period. And I think that that makes for more difficult negotiations than they might otherwise have been.
Well, we're going to look into this in much more detail in this hour. Mike Schuster, it's great to have you with us. Please stand by. We've got to take a short break. Mike Schuster, National Public Radio's diplomatic correspondent, is joining us from Los Angeles. We'll have more guests in just a moment. You can join the conversation. We're talking tonight about the winding case for war with Iraq and its implications for the U.S. effort there, the U.S. occupation there. Are you one of the 70% of Americans who believe Saddam was connected to the attacks of 9/11? And does the president's statement that there was no connection affect your view of the war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the winding case for war with Iraq, about that case, the shifting rationales, and their implications for the U.S. occupation, the U.S. effort in Iraq. You can join the conversation tonight. How important do you think the implied connection was to public support for the war? And what is the case for war now? Which story is it? Does it support the American effort there, short-term, mid-term, long-term? Join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Los Angeles by Mike Schuster, NPR diplomatic correspondent, and right now from Lexington, Massachusetts, by Stephen Van Evra, director of the Security Study Program at MIT, author of Causes of War, Power, and the Roots of Conflict. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Van Evra.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, great to have you with us, Steve. Also with us tonight from Columbus, Ohio, is John Mueller, professor of political science at Ohio State and author of Policy and Opinion in the Gulf War. Good evening and welcome, Professor Mueller.
Thank you. Good to be here.
John Mueller, to you first. You must have been watching on with interest. You have followed the interaction of public opinion and war over time. You looked at it clearly in the Gulf War. How do you see public opinion shaping the path of this war effort and occupation effort now? We heard Andrew Kohut say earlier that in a way the public is a player in this because the public so quickly went to the link between Iraq and 9/11.
Yeah, the player in there, also the voters next year, and the there were sort of three rationales for going into the war. One was the weapons of mass destruction issue. Another was the connection to terrorism, which also sometimes got connected to the weapons of mass destruction issue. And the third was basically humanitarian, getting rid of a terrible dictator. Mm-hmm. And the first of those two rationales now doesn't seem to be holding a whole lot of water, so they're basically left with the humanitarian venture. And Americans are willing to expend lives for various things, but expending lives for humanitarian ventures is relatively low on the list. And one of the reasons they didn't emphasize that, I think, in the run-up to war, is they didn't think they would get enough support for the war simply on that rationale, the humanitarian rationale.
So if it's a three-legged stool and it's leaning most heavily, in your view, on that leg now, what's your sense? You've watched these interactions before. What does it mean for the occupation and for the politics around it?
Well, the general idea is that the Americans might support humanitarian ventures, but they're not willing to expend a lot of lives for humanitarian ventures. I mean, if Japan attacks at Pearl Harbor, there's no question about expending lives, or attacks on 9/11, there's no question. So it's not that there wouldn't be support, it's just that the cost that they're willing to bear will tend to be lower. And we're already seeing some slippage over the summer, even with, you know, the casualties in an objective sense have been extremely low, just a handful, a few dozen who have been killed in, you know, real combat and
mm-hmm.
so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But there's already been a substantial slippage from a fairly high point at the end of the war. So like with Andy, I think I agree that there's going to be kind of a wearing effect over time. And also, if you still have people who say, well, we've got to finish the job, you know, we got in there, and maybe it's a bad war to get into, but now we got to, you know, make it work and so forth. They may also say that it was a mistake to have gotten in, and so from an election standpoint, that doesn't look too good. You say, well, we got to finish the job, but the guy who got us into this mistake was George Bush, and do we want four more years of him? In that case, it'd be similar to with Korea and Vietnam, in the sense that there was a fair amount of idea that we've got to somehow finish this thing. In the case of Vietnam, in particular, get our 500 prisoners, including John McCain, back. But at the same time, an increasing number of people thinking the war was a mistake. And in both those wars, Truman and Johnson decided it was probably not a very good idea to try to run again because they faced a pretty high probability of defeat.
So plenty of precedent for wars becoming referenda or presidential elections becoming referenda on wars.
Yes, well, they are. They're basically, you know, did George Bush do a good job in 4 years? And if you think he's made a big mistake in this war, that should obviously enter your vote calculus.
Steve Van Evra, on both sides of the aisle in Washington now, we hear, you know, whether it's Republican leaders or Democrat Joe Biden and others, we hear political leaders saying,
however we got in here, we've got to carry through with this. We've got to make this end positively for Iraq and for the United States. If that's the case, it almost suggests at this point, in some sense, that the U.S. is there because it's there. Does the rationale really matter anymore, given the commitment?
Well, I think you're right that nobody in Washington is calling for withdrawal. Even all the folk who are against the war agree we have to stay there and finish the job. But I think that everything for the president politically rides on how well he handles the occupation. If he can turn this occupation around and make it look good, people are going to forget their questions about why we got in. They're going to forget their complaints about the shading of the truth and the case for war. But if this occupation continues to look like it's not on a good trajectory, the questions about why we got in are going to be asked louder and louder and louder. Especially because, as John and Mike Schuster were saying, the original case gets more and more shaky as we learn more and more about it. And the way I look at it right now, it's hard to make a case that the trajectory we're on looks good. If you just look at the trend line over the last 3 or 4 months, it doesn't seem that the administration has a plan for turning the corner in Iraq. They don't seem to have a plan in particular for defeating this insurgency and establishing security. And if they can't do that, nothing else is going to go right.
So John Mueller was saying just a moment ago that Americans are, as I interpret him, most likely to support a war if they feel it's in response to a direct hit or threat to the country. I asked Mike Schuster earlier about probe maybe Dick Cheney's motivations for coming up close to that line on Sunday, and he's too much the good reporter to do that. But what about you, Stephen Van Evra? When the vice president appeared to try to draw energy from that assumption of a link between 9/11 and Saddam, was that the administration trying to pull that sort of ultimate justification further into the public spotlight to keep the public support on board?
If you want me to guess, I'm always reluctant to guess about motives, but I think the way you laid out the situation is correct. The WMD case has fallen apart, and as John was saying, the humanitarian case can't sustain a policy that costs us a lot. The American people are all for doing the human rights thing and helping the Iraqi people, but they won't support a policy that's based on human rights that costs us anything. So the one leg in the stool that really persuades the American people is the terror stool, and I think Cheney was reaching for the one leg left. And I think he overreached. He made a mistake. He didn't foresee how many questions his statements were going to generate. But that's what I think he was doing.
Mike Schuster, isn't it pretty unusual for a president to come out and appear to contradict his vice president, especially in a team as close as this one, just a couple of days after the VP was on the TV?
Well, I think it is unusual, but as I said, there were comments made by other senior members of the administration before President Bush made his comments, the defense secretary and the national security advisor. So I think we have to assume that there was probably a discussion about this within the White House after Vice President Cheney's comments, and there may have been a decision to in effect, set the record straight. Go ahead.
Well, just that I wonder, why come out so clearly in contradiction at this point? Is there a political calculus here? If the vice president's gone too far in making this connection, a fear of a political albatross going into a campaign season that would be thrown back in the president's face, he needed to staunch it right now?
That very well may have been the case. After all, if there is no concrete case to be made, no evidence that exists between Saddam Hussein and the September 11th attacks, the fact that Vice President Cheney had put it on the table meant that it was going to get discussed a lot. It could have been attacked easily by the Democrats, but the press was not going to let it alone because it's a very emotive and strong thing to be out there. And the White House may have simply made the political and diplomatic decision to staunch it there because they couldn't then follow it up with details of a case to be made.
John Mueller, you track public opinion and war. If Stephen Van Evra is right and the trajectory of the U.S. effort in Iraq, if you plot it over the past weeks, is not good, who wouldn't hope that it improves? We pray that it does. But if it doesn't, how would you expect, looking at patterns of history, how would you expect this administration to begin to package, if you will, the war and occupation effort?
Well, what they could try to do is essentially cut and run. In other words, declare victory and leave. It seems to be something of a move in that direction. People talking about Iraqization and so forth. And
despite all the calls that the commitment must be firm and we have to stay there till it's all done right.
Yeah, well, they just say, well, it's done right, so we're leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Iraq was a pretty well-run country in the sense that you could walk the streets without fear. You couldn't say things mm-hmm. without fear, but you could walk the streets. And the possibility of moving much faster, which Rumsfeld seems to be suggesting, to get more Iraqi police and Iraqi military forces in there, and then get into a condition which basically you can either withdraw the Americans or just get them on bases where they can't be killed, would mean that this thing would very much simmer down. The key thing, as both Steve and Andy Kohut at the beginning mentioned, is this sort of drain of casualties, and if Americans aren't being killed, no one really cares where they are. You know, they could be in Kansas or they could be in Bosnia. No one cares. It's also the case that people are fairly willing to cut and run when things are not terribly important. In Somalia, Clinton cut and ran, and people didn't even come up in the next election. In Lebanon, Reagan cut and ran and didn't come up in the next election. And even in Vietnam, total debacle, and it barely came up in the 1976 election.
Well, the investment here is certainly on a far grander scale than Somalia or Lebanon. Vietnam, another kettle of fish.
It's not grander than Vietnam.
No, not that. That's true. Stephen Evra, what about those options? A, cut and run. B, hunker down. Get into the bunker in Iraq in security terms, in tactical, strategic terms. Are those options?
I think we can cut and run in a limited sense, which is abandon the democracy project and simply try to find a new authoritarian group to put in charge and call that a day and pull out. But if we don't establish order first, there is the risk we're going to leave the country in a state of growing civil war. A lot of pieces are in place for this country to have a civil war. You got, three main groups don't like each other. You got no civil society. You got guns everywhere. You got growing warlordism. And a major civil war in Iraq is a situation that we don't want to leave behind.
And spell that out exactly, because the higher the price gets, the more coldly that may be observed.
Iraq is a failed state, point one. It would be a tremendous favor to al-Qaeda. It would become the new playground for al-Qaeda, the new Afghanistan, if you will, where they could run, hide, make friends, find sanctuaries. It also could spread to nearby states. Civil wars have a tendency to widen, and this is a part of the world we badly don't want to have a general conflict. It'll be a tremendous PR problem for us because the Islamic world, everyone who doesn't like us in the Islamic world is going to be saying, look at what the Americans do. They come into the Middle East, take countries over and smash them, mm-hmm. leaving a wreck behind. Aren't they great? So I think leaving behind a state of incipient civil war is just not an option.
And hunkering down, pulling the troops back into bunkers and fortresses?
Well, I do want to, and I think that'll make our job there easier. I want to put more of an Iraqi face on the government that we have there and more of a UN face on the project we have there. And I want far more foreign and Arab troops involved in defeating this insurgency. I mean, the Bush guys have made a huge blunder, I think, in not inviting our Arab friends to come in and help us with the police problem here. What we really need here are lots of Arab-speaking police in that country. And the Jordanians offered to help us and have their cops come in and help look around. And, they know the language. They can talk a talk on the streets, and we turned them down. This has been a big mistake.
So a little hunkering down and a lower profile and some other people on the streets might be a good idea. We're talking tonight about the winding case for war with Iraq and its implications for the U.S. occupation. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Peter's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
What's the question?
Well, we put out a bunch of questions. The first one was whether or not you're among that majority of Americans who see the link between Iraq, Saddam Hussein, and 9/11's attacks, in spite of what the president said this week.
No, I heard Mike Schuster quoting Cheney, and the way Cheney's statement is one I would agree with, and it's not what you're saying it was. What I heard him say was not that Iraq had any direct link to 9/11 or that he was saying ever said they did. But what he's saying is that many people believe that Iraq had ties to al-Qaeda and terrorism. And in my case, not only that, I think that the chances in the future, if we hadn't taken these steps, those would increase. And particularly if using terrorists as a proxy Massoud, who was saying particularly that he had weapons that he could provide them with, such as chemical and biological weapons.
So you didn't see such an explicit a nod by the vice president to this linkage. Let me put that to Mike Schuster. And, Peter, thanks for your call. Mike, there was some interpretation required here, but people tended to rather uniformly interpret it as pressing that line. How do you read it?
Well, I think the vice president did say things that were open to interpretation, but the odd thing that he said was that in going to war in Iraq, the U.S. is striking a blow at, and this is a quote, the geographic base of the terrorists who had us under assault now for many years, but most especially on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the United States went to war in Afghanistan because that was the geographic base of al-Qaeda, and it was believed that al-Qaeda launched the attacks that on September 11th. So, and I think until now, everyone has agreed that that was the geographic base and that terrorism specialists, at least when they cite some of the gains of the war on terrorism, say that now the geographic base for training and organization of operations like 9/11 in Afghanistan have been removed. Why the vice president would choose then to use the term geographic base in connection with Iraq is somewhat odd. And he was taken to task very robustly by Senator Robert Byrd on the floor of the Senate the following day for using just those words.
Mm-hmm.
Can I add one thing on that?
John Mueller, please.
In some respects, it may take a logician here, and I think Boston has quite a few of those, so maybe they should be on the air. But in some respects, the President and Cheney said the same thing. It's just the tone is so different. Cheney was asked, do you think there's a link between Saddam Hussein and 9/11? And he said, we don't know. The president was asked that, and he said, there is no evidence. Now, those are logically, I think, the same thing. They're just the tone is radically different. The I don't know is probably what the president should have said.
Hmm. Stephen Everly, I just got a minute before the break, but let me put the vice president's comments to you. Apply the truth-o-meter here. How credible? How truthful?
It seems to me, I agree with Mike Schuster, he's implying that the 9/11 emanated from Iraq by the geographic base. When he uses that phrase, what he seems to be saying is, and 9/11 emanated from Iraq. And he's implying it. He's not using the word Iraq, but I think any American listening to that, that's what they're going to hear.
And of course, as Mike says, it was Afghanistan.
Yes, exactly. That's where I think that there was zero connection. I think not only is it clear that there's no evidence that Iraq had any involvement in 9/11, but the evidence of any connection between Saddam's regime and al-Qaeda is extremely thin, extremely thin.
John Mueller, I heard you there in the background.
Yes. I was just saying the president is also saying that he did say there's no link with Saddam Hussein,
mm-hmm.
but he did say he said there's no evidence of that, but he did, like Cheney, talk about possible links of al-Qaeda to the Iraq in general and the Iraq regime in general. So it isn't all that much difference, but I do think that the phrase has been around all the time is there is no evidence of a connection, and the Republicans have never really said that. The Democrats have. And now the president slipped into it seems to me.
But a lot of language here right up against the boundaries of truth. We're talking tonight about the winding case for war with Iraq and its implications for the U.S. occupation there. You can join the conversation. Are all the rationales irrelevant now? Just talk for the historians to sort out. Are we there? Because we're there. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the winding case for war with Iraq and its implications for the U.S. occupation. My guests are NPR diplomatic correspondent Mike Schuster, joining us from Los Angeles. From Lexington, Massachusetts, Stephen Van Evra, director of the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And from Columbus, Ohio, John Mueller, professor of political science at Ohio State University and author of Policy and Opinion. In the Gulf War, you can join the conversation as well. What is the case for war now? What's going to sustain support for a $1 billion a week war tab? And why did President Bush come out and so publicly, so plainly this week, deny the Saddam 9/11 connection? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Peggy's calling from Berea, Kentucky. Hi, Peggy. You're on the air.
Thank you. First of all, let me say that this program is one of the most exciting I have listened to in many years. Really, truly.
Well, that's great. What's on your mind tonight, Peggy?
Well, I'm one of a large group of people who never found a connection between the happenings on 9/11 and the Iraqis. And the more I read and the more I listened, the less I understood and the less I believed. What I'm thinking now is that the best most of us can hope for is that this apparent disarray in the administrative line is going to be public, and it will maybe cause other people to question. I'm afraid that as a world, nation, whatever, we're inclined to just accept what we're told and run along like a bunch of sheep.
Well, Peggy, let me ask you this. What is your interpretation of your American brothers and sisters, 70% of them, who do see this connection and who saw it from 2 days after 9/11, or at least suspected it that early? How do you interpret that? They weren't even being told by anyone to look in that direction at the beginning.
Well, I'm not sure I remember ever reading or hearing that that was true 2 days after 9/11.
Well, there was a Time CNN poll, September 13th, 2001.
Weren't we then looking toward Afghanistan rather than Iraq?
Yes.
And weren't we looking for Osama bin Laden, who was definitely not from Iraq?
So you think it is because of government suggestion that such a large majority have had that view?
I think that's a good possibility, because I can remember sitting in groups and saying, well, we couldn't find Osama bin Laden. Perhaps Saddam Hussein will do. Hmm. I mean, I don't believe much of what this administration tells me. I don't know. Apparently, I'm not in the 70-something percent of people who are inclined to. I don't think the American people came to this sudden awareness that Iraq was involved on their own.
Mm. Peggy, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. Stephen Vannevar, I want to put this to you. As you look at it, as a security analyst, a strategy guy, is it possible that the American public has got something fundamentally right here? I mean, the fundamental connection we heard at the top from Andy Kohut is that Americans, a majority of Americans, see the war in Iraq as related to, as a legitimate part of, the war on terror. As a strategy analyst, and knowing the facts that you know, do you see that as a credible view, or is it fundamentally flawed?
I think the best case you can make for that is a buried case that people don't talk about much, which is that defeating Saddam did two things to help the U.S. deal with Islamic radicals and with al-Qaeda. One, and both had to do with Saudi Arabia. It allows us to disentangle ourselves from the Saudis.
That is, pull the bases out of Saudi Arabia.
Yes,
pull the troops out.
It allows us to get the troops out of Saudi Arabia and to end the sanctions, which has been a major complaint that Arabs have made against the U.S. and Iraq. And getting the troops out of Saudi Arabia puts us in a better position to have a confrontation with the Saudis. And the Saudis are a real problem in the war on terror. They are the fount of the Wahhabist, Islamist, hate ideology that from which al-Qaeda draws its strength. And someday we're going to have to jawbone them into changing their tune on that, putting it under control, stopping the export of this Wahhabist idea.
So it's costing us a lot, but on the other hand, you're saying there are some positives here. On balance, was it worth it? Is it worth it?
Well, I was against the war because I thought on balance we should focus on al-Qaeda, that al-Qaeda was the greater threat. There was this benefit to getting the troops out of Saudi Arabia. That would deflate one of the al-Qaeda arguments. It was also a big benefit to get rid of the sanctions on Iraq, because that would deflate another of their arguments. On balance, though, I was worried and remain very worried that we've drained a lot of resources into this war that we should be using against al-Qaeda. And we've also given al-Qaeda a great recruiting device. Al-Qaeda is using it around the world, and all the reports are that it's working, and that al-Qaeda is finding it a way to recruit people. And thirdly, we've given al-Qaeda a flank to attack. They didn't have a good flank to attack before we went into Iraq. And Iraq is an ideal a battleground for them to come get us. The administration's been saying, hey, bring them on. We welcome the battle in Iraq. I have the opposite view. We've presented them with a theater where they can do us damage. They didn't have one before.
Mike Schuster, the administration has positively welcomed this, though, it seems. I mean, they've said this is now the central battlefield. George Bush is saying better to confront them there than here.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that was the point of what President Bush said, that welcoming that. But I think that it is true that increasingly the war in Iraq may be a war between foreign fighters, allied directly or loosely with al-Qaeda and U.S. troops. And this could be, I think, a real problem for the arc of the U.S. occupation. It may not allow the United States to hunker down, and it may not allow the United States to make all the decisions about how it wants to fight in Iraq. There's a good deal of information that several thousand foreign fighters have come across the now very porous borders of Iraq. Several hundred are already in U.S. Prisons in Iraq. And as Stephen said, al-Qaeda is recruiting on the basis of this. So this, if Iraq wasn't about the war on terror initially, it may become so quite soon.
William's calling from Plymouth, Wisconsin. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm calling. I'm a former SEAL team operator. Okay, just to let you know.
Navy SEALs? Bad. Navy SEALs, you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay.
I was special warfare in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
I spent time in Beirut, Lebanon. I was there for approximately a year. We're looking at 25 years ago in October when the barracks were actually attacked in Beirut.
Right.
I believe truly that this was just an open target for the administration to go after in Iraq. They weren't actually looking at an al-Qaeda target. They were looking for an open target.
And why?
Well, I believe Bush had to satisfy some people in finding a target. And he had nowhere to find a target other than Saddam Hussein.
Are you saying Afghanistan wasn't enough?
Absolutely, it wasn't enough. It was not enough. He didn't have enough money. It all boils down to dollars and cents, I believe.
But are you saying, William, that he needed it for strategic reasons or a kind of national emotional reasons?
I think it's a little of both. It's a mental game, I think, that it more so than anything. So make people feel, you know, a little more, you know, fluffy.
Yeah, we've got it, and our time is short, but thank you for your call. John Mueller, this looks like it's in your bailiwick. Is there a kind of, I don't know, national psyche that demands a balancing of the ledger that somehow favored this effort just out of a kind of sense of getting our own back?
Well, there was some in terms of the Afghanistan war of getting back at the actual terrorists, and there has also been a long hostility, to say the least, towards Saddam Hussein. But the president was not really able during the whole run-up to the war to increase the public support for the war, nor was his father for the first war, as a matter of fact. And it didn't seem like there was any kind of groundswell of public opinion pushing him into the war. Many people like Richard Pearl were saying, we'll get the support after the war starts, not beforehand, and to a degree that happened. But now that is, of course, dissipating. I just want to agree with Steve that, of course, what we've done now is present targets, not find targets, but present targets to al-Qaeda. And it's the basic dilemma is pretty deep, because what we want to do there is police the situation. But policing generally means it works in an environment in which the police are not targets. In other words, there aren't a lot of cop killers out there. Mm. There are bad people out there, and they're burglars, and sometimes they kill police running away from banks that they rather than getting caught and so forth. But they're not setting out to kill the cops. And that, with that kind of environment, you can actually have a police system that works. If you actually have a lot of people who actually want to kill the police, then the only way to save police is keep them in the station house. In other words, they can't police. So that's why it seems to me that there's a reasonable thing is to move this more over to the Iraqis, who might be able to handle it.
And I'm
somewhat more optimistic than Steve. I agree with all his concerns of things that might happen, civil war and so forth. But I think there's a reasonable chance that the Iraqis are fairly sophisticated people. Who are totally exhausted because of the last 10 years, last 20 years.
John Mueller, we've got it, and we're out of time, but we'll watch for the evolution of the rationale to cover that move. John Mueller is professor of political science at Ohio State. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. And Stephen Van Evra, director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. Great to have you with us. And Mike Schuster, in Los Angeles, NPR diplomatic correspondent. Thank you so much for being with us tonight, Mike.
You're welcome.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, resurrecting Monteverde's Vespers. This is On Point. growing up in China during the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s, director Chen Shizheng noticed his neighbors placing Virgin Mary statues on their home altars, the traditional realm of Buddhist and Taoist figures. He was captivated by their devotion to the gentle icon of Roman Catholicism. Years later, Shizheng heard Claudio Monteverde's Vespers, evening prayers to the Virgin Mary, set to music in 1610 while directing a Chinese opera. His fascination reawakened. He heard its potential as a healing bridge between cultures. Chen's production of Monteverdi's Vespers makes its debut this weekend in Boston. In this radio diary, Chen Shizheng recalls his feelings the first time he heard Monteverdi's Vespers.
When I heard the Vespers first come to me, it was a beautiful love song, glorious beauty that is dedicated to the love icon, Virgin Mary, which reminded me of what I've seen in both in China and in countryside. Many Chinese peasants who are not Catholic, but they somehow would worship Virgin Mary. When I was a child, I thought it was very, very striking, and I found that, you know, in the most poor area, that in the most loveless space, that people actually are longing for this kind of love. And even though the Virgin Mary is a Western invention, it has reached out and connect people that has no relationship to this culture yet, was singled out as a love icon. And I thought if I could stage a piece that bring that perspective, that kind of love that has reached so far away from other side of the world, and create a production for people to see, and in a time that is so much conflict and hatred between the race, between the country, and that would be something very important in America. Monteverdi's music is just full of delicacy and refinement and this beautiful expression. I found a lot of Asian dancing from Indonesia, Javanese court dance, and from China has equal amount of ornamentation and gesture and delicate. And I thought this music actually goes together with the movement without feel like this is the East, this is the West. Actually, almost like made for each other. What I'm trying to achieve is open a dialogue between this different culture, to have that conversation, to use this both reference to create a new work, that when you come to see it, you realize that this is not about period instrument or period music anymore. This is some music we could all understand, all feel, this sound of love. I have dancers who are Buddhist and Taoist and Catholic, and also Muslim dancers from Indonesia. And now come here, come to Boston, to have that, the intention to make something about love from different culture, but from different race. In this world, I think it's very magnificent, and then it's very important for us to send this message. It's about love making, music making, or art making, that it has this positive harmonious energy in it. And I felt through the rehearsal room in the theater, I think it is very much a part of a joy of working a piece.
Chen Shizheng has collaborated with Boston's Handel and Haydn Society on the first fully staged production of Monteverdi's Vespers. The production debuts this weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.